is it okay if we just start already? I think rest of them mass bunks. Probably I would have start. Only he was there when I came, and I would have started the class just for him, I think. Okay, so let's begin. As I said, this is just for 1 hour, then we can take a break and come back and meet in the mini hall. Okay, so today's lecture is about the caste system of India. I'm only going to give you a very brief introduction as to what this topic is about. Nothing in detail as such. How it is prevalent in India today, what is the history of it, and the basic introduction. Okay, to understand the caste system of India, first, as we always go through different topics, we've always gone through the definitions first. The problem with this topic is that there is no definition for caste system or caste as such. The reason is because caste system was something that has to be understood from multiple perspectives. It is not something that you can just define and understand the entire society through that definition. So what we're going to do instead is, without defining the caste system, okay, so without definition, we're going to look at multiple aspects from which we can understand the entire situation as such. So look at this. What we're going to do is first understand the history of caste system. For history, we're going to start all the way from Vedic period, a little bit before that, and the colonial history of India. And then we go on to what is caste system today, what is the relevance to today's India. So that's the four different things. And one main aspect is that in India, the administration also depends upon this societal reality. Therefore, we are going to talk a little bit about the governance system and how it is influenced by the caste system today. So for the history of caste system, where did the system come from? You have many theories, about 6 to 7 theories, but none of them with substantial proof. So we are not going to say this is the only way that caste system originated. I'll give you a brief idea about all the theories that are there regarding the origin of the caste system. We don't know as such. You have to understand that in India, people live in the caste system as a reality, but nobody really asks where it came from. How did it originate? And because this system originated about 2600 years ago, approximately, and I will explain to you why we use the term 2600. Before that, you didn't have a lot of written evidences or manuscripts or anything from which you could identify the origin as such. There was no one sitting and writing down, okay, so we are going to live in this particular way. This is the rules that we have to follow. So when you go back to the theories, you see there's one very interesting theory, which is called as the divine theory or the divine origin theory. This comes from Hinduism as a religion. And it is believed that you have Lord Brahma, who is the creator of the world and the people. And when he created the world, he created different sections of the population from different parts of his body. So the people who originated out of the head part of Lord Brahma, they are called as Brahmins. They are the ritualistically pure part of the society. Ritualistically pure meaning, they are the only ones that are allowed to act as priests in temples. They are the only ones who are allowed to read the holy scriptures, and only with the help of a Brahmin can one go through the different rituals in one's life to get married, to do all the birth ceremonies when someone has died, to do the funeral rites. For all these things, you need a Brahmin priest. So to go through all the rites of passages, you are completely dependent. If you are in any other part of the society, you are completely dependent on the Brahmin part of the population. Then those who were created out of, Lord Brahma's torso, they are called as Kshatriyas. They are warriors or soldiers. In different cases, they are protectors. So basically people who fought to protect the people, their own community. So they are called as Kshatriyas. So all the kings in the medieval period and before that, they come from the Kshatriya community. And then you have the Vaishyas, who were born out of the thighs of Lord Brahma. And from the thighs, these people became traders, merchants. They were, if you see, all those who were engaged in any type of business, including trading of silk, cloth, spices, or they were just bangle makers or any sort of activity like this where they were producing something for the community, they were called as Vaishyas. And finally, you have a section of population that were created from the feet of Lord Brahma, and they are called as Shudras. Shudras here, many people confuse Shudras with the Dalit section of Indian population. Shudras are simply people who were engaged in manual labor. So physical labor, someone who pulled the cart, or maybe they built furniture, small things like this. They were manual laborers and they were called as Shudras. Outside of this system exists a group of population who today we call them as Dalits. According to this system, they were considered as untouchable people. The ones who were not belonging to either of the four groups, Brahmins, Kshatriyas, Vaishyas or Shudras. These untouchables, they typically performed works like manual scavenging, cleaning one's toilets, cleaning the latrines or pit latrines of other people's houses. They were sweepers. Then you could see that they were making shoes, or they were cobblers. Basically, the idea is that those who were considered as untouchables, they did physically polluting jobs. And this, if you see, there's an anthropologist called Louis Dumont who talks about this concept of caste system as purity and pollution. What divides the Dalits from the Brahmins is the concept of purity and pollution. Brahmins are the purest of the section, purest of all the population. Ritualistically, they hold the highest section of the Indian society, whereas Dalits are in the lowermost rung of the hierarchy. And you can see here how they are divided into different sections of the population. So this is just one theory. There is another theory called occupational theory. This is called as divine theory. We go to the other theory, it is called as occupational theory. And in occupational theory, people believe that different communities had different occupations in India. So you had, if you notice even today, a lot of caste systems, their identity remains on who they were in the past, what business or what jobs they did in history. So historically, every community specialized in one type of occupation. So you had a group of people who were priests, they raised their children to be priests. You had a group of people who were cobblers, they raised their children to be cobblers. So like this, you had different groups specializing in different jobs. Therefore, caste system could have originated. Then you have another theory called evolution theory. In evolution theory, the idea is that over time, you had so many different communities, a diverse set of population in India, it was possible that gradually people sorted themselves into a hierarchy. This is just typical evolution sort of idea. So the theories are not limited to just these three, but we'll stop here. And all these are just ideas as to where caste system could have originated. Then we'll fast forward a little bit to the Vedic era, which is around 600 BC up to 2 to 3rd century AD. So a period of about 800 to 900 years. So that is called in India as the Vedic era. What we know about the Vedic era is that there was a significant native population living in India around 600 BC. A group of people come from the outskirts of India, mostly from the Central Asian region, from the side of Pakistan, Afghanistan, the Baloch area and all that. A group of people migrate into India. And this today we call that as Aryan migration. But do we know exactly when they migrated? No. But the idea is that a group of people did, because these people spoke an Indo-European language. And all the scriptures that they wrote were in that Indo-European language, which is, let's say, an older version of Sanskrit. Sanskrit is one of those languages. And these people, they wrote a bunch of books. We call them as Vedas, and they became the holy scriptures for the Brahmin community. And the holy scriptures were the material through which one can become a priest. So you have to study all the Vedas to become a priest, right? So these Vedas, they mention a very interesting thing. They mention that when the pure part of the society, when they came and settled in India, there were already a group of people existing who had darker skin color, and they were referred to as Dasa people. D-A-S-A, Dasa people. So in the Vedas, if you see different parts of the scriptures, you see that they are mentioning that they were Dasas. Dasa people did different types of jobs. We do different types of jobs. Dasa people have different gods. We have different gods. So basically, they mentioned that there were a group of people who were natives and who had slightly different skin color. And if you see, the word caste system, it came into existence only during the colonial time period. A lot before that, we were calling this the Varna system or the Varna model of Indian society. And even during the Vedic period, they called the caste or the caste identity of a person was referred to as one's Varna. So they would ask you, imagine you are in the Vedic period, and if someone wants to know what is your caste as you understand it today, they would come and ask you, what is your Varna? Varna in that language means two things. It can mean color or it can mean occupation. That is why, if you notice here, morphologically speaking, if you observe Indian population, you can see that the skin color changes from top to bottom. You see very light skin tone for the Brahmins, and when you go down all the way towards Dalits or Shudras, you see darker skin tone emerging. It could be, genetically speaking, a mix of two different skin colored populations. And maybe during the Vedic time period, the mixing of two populations led to the organization of such a hierarchy. Or if you were looking at Varna as an occupation, it could be that they were all performing different jobs. And depending on the status and dignity of the jobs within the context of that particular society, it is possible they organized themselves into a hierarchical position. And somewhere around the 1st and 2nd century, a book called Manusmriti is written. It is part of the Vedic society, and this book is called as Laws of Manu. A codified version of what to do, how to behave, what is right, what is wrong when you live as part of the Vedic society. So everybody at that time period, they had to abide by the laws written in Manusmriti. You can find different versions of Manusmriti online, just if you want to read about it. And Manusmriti talks about a very interesting thing. Caste system as we know today in India, the reality is that if you belong to one caste, you're not allowed to marry someone from another caste. You marry only within your caste. Caste endogamy is practiced. But whereas in Manusmriti, there are two interesting things that are written. Two laws. One is called as hypergamy. The other is called as hypogamy. There is a provision through which someone from the Brahmin caste could marry someone from the other castes or the other categories. But there was a small clause here. Since this was a patriarchal society, the children always belonged to the fathers. Therefore, a man from a Brahmin community can marry a woman from any of the other groups, because the child would ultimately belong to the man and his status is not going to change. So this was called as hypergamy or anuloma. Then you had another case called hypogamy, where a man from a lower community marrying a woman from a upper community, or someone from Shudras, Vaishyas or Kshatriyas marrying someone from the Brahmin group. That is called as hypogamy. But the interesting thing here is that this, as a law, was mentioned in Manusmriti, which means strict endogamy was never practiced as we know it today. Today there are very rigid laws, and only about 5% of all marriages in India are intercaste marriages. So you have about 1 billion people living in India. And if you calculate that, the amount of people who marry out of caste is very insignificant, and arranged marriages or marriages within the caste is the reality, social reality in India. And then we go on to the colonial time period. So I would like you to imagine all the way from the Vedic period. Colonial period is about, let's say, 400 years ago. So in this gap, we don't know exactly how caste system evolved. But we know one thing for sure. The rules of hypergamy and hypogamy, They dissolved over time, and caste system, each community and their endogamy practices became more and more rigid. So when the Portuguese first came to India, they were not able to understand what is this different type of communities that they have, what are these different rules. See, for example, when you have the untouchables living in the periphery of a village, what usually happens is that there are two different roads. All public commodities are not allowed to be used by the untouchables. So imagine an Indian village in that time period. It would typically be like this. You have a temple in the middle of the village. Right next to the temple, the upper caste people usually live, the Brahmins. Then you have the traders, and then you have all the other servicemen. At the periphery of the village, the untouchables usually live. So if they were doing any jobs for the other communities, they could come perform it, but then they were not allowed to make any physical contact with any of the upper caste people. Then they practiced something called commensality, meaning one could not take food or share water or share food with someone from the lower community. So an untouchable, even today, if you notice in many parts of India, especially rural India, if someone belonging to the untouchable community, they go and ask for water, they would either give the cup like this without touching you. If you were an untouchable, they would just drop the cup, or they give reusable cups. Reusable cups in the sense, coconut shells. We're not talking about plastic cups, but in villages, coconut shells. They just pour water in coconut shells and they will not take it back from you. And even when you return the plate or when you return the cup, you're supposed to just leave it outside the house and go. So no physical contact whatsoever. And this is a system that has that began somewhere during the Vedic period, and it has continued all the way today. So anyway, so there are these so many different rules regarding the society, which the colonial people couldn't comprehend. If you were part of the Indian society, it was easy for you to know who is an untouchable, who is from a Kshatriya caste, who is from a Vaishya caste, who is from a Brahmin caste, what is my relationship with all these different four categories and all these things, because you were raised in that part of the society. So what happened was, when the Portuguese came and saw this type of a society, to make it easy for them to understand, they said, we are going to call each ethnic group as a caste. Caste or casta in Portuguese means groups of people. That's all. It simply means groups of people. But because we converse so commonly in English today, we've started to adopt that term into the society. So up to that point, we did not use the word caste. Instead, every caste or ethnic group was identified their own varna. They had their own varna name, which later became the caste name, and today it continues to exist at the same way. So caste were simply groups of people, and they believed that these groups of people had this fourfold hierarchy that you see from the varna model. And this is the sort of reality through which they looked at the Indian society. And that spread to the British reign, and the British government also looked at the Indian society within this fourfold model: Brahmins, Kshatriyas, Vaishyas, Shudras, and the untouchables. Another interesting thing, so all the pictures I've used in this presentation, they're from this old book where 72 different castes have been drawn. This is somewhere around, I think, if I'm not wrong, about 300 to 400 years ago. And each of these pictures are paintings, and you can see the names of the caste written below. It's not legible, but some of the pictures I can show you. I'll zoom in and show you. Okay, so before we go on to the reality of the caste system today, what is common to caste system beginning from the Vedic era and all the way up to today? There are some features that have remained the same. Whereas if you see this fourfold hierarchy, it doesn't remain the same anymore. But the characteristics that is common to all castes in India is that, first thing is that the innate nature, meaning you're born into a caste. Especially today, you cannot change your caste. Caste has an ascribed status. So when you're born, you have a caste identity, and you have to live with that caste identity till you die. There is no changing that particular part of you. Next is a strict endogamy, meaning you only marry within your own caste. More specifically, all castes practice caste endogamy and they practice clan exogamy. So a caste typically looks like this. So you have a large group of people, let's say about hypothetically about 500 people. Each 100 people would probably belong to a subgroup called a clan. And all the members of a clan are consanguineously related, meaning they are all related to each other by blood. So a person belonging to a clan will not marry another person from the same clan because that would be considered as incest. And this clan identity within a caste is traced through the father's clan identity because it was a patriarchal, it is a patriarchal society. So clan exogamy and caste endogamy. Then the hierarchy, as we already saw, you have the fourfold hierarchy, but hierarchy exists today in India, but not in the same way. We'll see a little bit later as to what kind of hierarchy we have today. Commensality, as put forward by Louis Dumont, he talks about how there is the purity and pollution, how the untouchables cannot share food. So food rules easily help one to understand which one is considered as the upper caste, which one is considered as a lower caste. You see, within this hierarchy, the Brahmins do not eat meat. Kshatriyas, Vaishyas and Shudras, they eat meat, but they do not eat beef and they do not eat wild meat. This was the basic idea. Whereas the Dalits, they had no restrictions on what they ate. Historically speaking, not today, but historically. So this food hierarchy followed by how they exchanged food. See, for example, a Vaishya could take food from a Kshatriya. A Kshatriya could take food from a Brahmin. If they were offering food, you could borrow and eat. But a Brahmin would not take food from a Kshatriya. A Kshatriya would not take food from a Vaishya. And so on. So if you are from the lower part of the society, you are allowed to eat from someone in the upper part of the society or the upper hierarchy. So this is called as commensality. Next is the occupational restrictions. Every caste had their own job or their own specialized occupation. So we know that there was a time period when changing the occupation meant changing the caste identity. It was probably before Manusmriti was written and the caste rules became solidified. So before that, it was possible that when a person changed their varna or occupation in this sense, they could change their caste. But today, caste identity simply is drawn from a historical occupation because you have so many different jobs today. Nobody is specializing through generations for just being a cobbler, or nobody specializing through generations to just be a farmer. So today the socio-economic conditions are a lot different. But occupational identity was there and occupational restrictions. A cobbler cannot become a priest. A priest will not go and do manual scavenging or clean the toilets. So anyone who is born into a particular caste will follow their caste identity or occupation. Finally, you have what we call as advantages and disadvantages of being or belonging to one particular caste. So imagine if there was someone who belonged to the upper caste. Since they had the highest status in the society, they could freely use any public services. They could go anywhere they want. They were always respected and people looked up to them. Imagine a Dalit's community or a Dalit's family. They couldn't use the same wells or public places that the Brahmins frequented. So in typical Indian villages, there were always two wells. Wells where you draw water from. So you have two wells. One is for the upper caste group and one is for the untouchables. Usually the ones in the middle, Kshatriyas and Vaishyas and all of them, they used the same one as the Brahmins. The Dalits had a separate space. And in temples, if you notice, when the Brahmin priest is inside, the Vaishyas and the Kshatriyas, they can enter the temples and go pray to the god. Whereas the Dalits, they always stayed outside the temple. They stayed outside the temple, they prayed and they left. So that physical space, the organization of physical space was very important in understanding the caste system. And this is also a disability if you look at it. And especially when it has been carried over to the Indian society today, people still continue to follow that. So calling someone by an offensive term, or sometimes in villages you see just because someone took water from a Brahmin well, they are beaten up. All these things that happened in the recent years. So that disabilities and privileges. Privileges for someone who is in the upper caste, that continues. So these features are common to the caste system today and were also present in the historical caste system. But then a lot of things have changed between the Vedic time period and today. So that is another thing that we can look at. So some questions to ask, because we've been talking only about four caste groups, Brahmins, Kshatriyas, Vaishyas and Shudras. Are there only four caste groups in India? This is one thing we can address. Second thing, what are the marriage rules within one category and between categories? Can a Kshatriya marry a Brahmin? Can a Vaishya marry a Kshatriya? Or within the Vaishya category, you have smaller subgroups. Can each subgroup marry someone from another subgroup within the same category? So this is another question to address. Do Brahmins always hold the upper position or the highest status in the society? When you raise these three questions, you can understand the reality of the caste system today. The first thing is, there are more than four caste groups in India. Actually, if you look at it, you don't have these four groups at all. These four groups are categories in which numerous small ethnic groups are categorized. You can see here, the historical view was like this, right? So you had the hierarchy, you had four groups. But what was the reality as put forward by this Indian anthropologist and sociologist called M.N. Srinivas? He explains it in a slightly different way, which is actually the reality of caste system, which has always been the reality of caste system, except that for an outsider, it is very difficult to understand this. So many complex rules which are region specific, which are community specific. Therefore, it was easier to understand the Indian society from this point of view. So when you take a look at this, what I've done here is I've made different colored circles to signify different communities or different ethnic groups, each with their own specific occupation. So let's assume all those with the pink colored circles. In every region, each of them are doing the job of a priest. Are they all priests for the same temple or the same god? No. For Hinduism, since you have such a big pantheon and so many gods, 33 million gods are there, every region have their own gods. And every region has its own temple, and temple rules also vary from one state to another state. And in each temple, you have a priest. The priest from south of India need not share the same ideology or values as the priest from the north of India. This has always been a social reality. And all these priests do not belong to one big caste. They belong to their own region-specific Brahmin community. And when you're looking at it from a collective point of view, you call all the priests as Brahmins. Does a Brahmin from south of India go looking for a bride in a Brahmin community from the north of India? No. But historically, this type of marriage was allowed. In Manusmriti, this was allowed because they only looked at the society from four categories. But today, each community have their own identity, and that identity is region specific, and they do not like to marry someone from another group. At least it's very easy to identify Brahmins wherever you go because they have this very typical identity of being priests. What about all the other jobs? Actually, if you look at the Vaishya category, it simply says merchants, traders, farmers, landowners, all those who come under this category. Farmers. In south of India, if you notice, you have so many subcastes and individual castes today within the farming community. Those who farmed turmeric have their own caste. Those who farmed or cultivated rice have their own caste. Those who cultivated maize, they had their own caste. So even within agriculture, depending on what they specialized in, they had their own particular caste. Did someone who cultivated turmeric, did they marry someone from the rice community? The idea today is that they don't. During the pre-Vedic times or before Manusmriti was written, it was possible that they married within this own, each married within a category. But the social reality of India is that they don't. Everybody has their own small caste group, small identity, a very small number of people within their own caste. So imagine now, all these are different groups of people with their own jobs and their own identity, and each of them are region specific. Although they have different rules in each region, when you're looking at it from a bird's eye point of view, this is what happens. Can you see? All those who had similar jobs, not same jobs, similar jobs, were put into these categories. They were just put into these categories, but doesn't make them all one. So each individual circle here under the Vaishya category talk about a specific caste. They might come under the broad category of Vaishyas, but doesn't mean that they are all under one identity. The historical view, as in during the Vedic time period and pre-Vedic time period, is that hypergamy and hypogamy was practiced. Marrying into another category or someone from a caste in another category was allowed through the laws of Manusmriti. Brahmins always held the highest position because they were considered ritualistically pure. Change of occupation in pre-Vedic times could have led to change of the caste identity. Assuming that the occupational theory for origin of caste was true, then change of occupation could change the caste identity. But what is the social reality today? As put forward by M.N. Srinivas, strict endogamy, meaning each of these circles, which signifies different castes in different parts of India. So you have the Shudras all over India, right? You have the Brahmins all over India. So each of them have their own marriage practices and they practice endogamy, meaning they marry only within their own caste. So if you look at this, even within this category, one group is only marrying within themselves. They're not going to marry even with another Shudra and someone from the Shudra category with a different occupation or a different identity. And they're not going to marry someone from any of the other categories. So strict endogamy was practiced. And again, M.N. Srinivas, he also came up with another idea which actually talks about or explains Indian society in the best way. He says that in every region, in every region of India, Brahmins might be holding the highest position through a historical status. But are they the most dominant and the most powerful part of any society today? Any region specific society today? No. Especially throughout history, Brahmins have only enjoyed a high social status, but economic status and power in terms of political status, all that were always in the hands of other communities. And this is a region specific reality. So in India, if you notice, every region, every state or every small city, every linguistic region or linguistic area have their own powerful caste, which we call as dominant caste. So you have a ritualistically high status caste, which is the Brahmins, and then you have a dominant caste. In any region, you can randomly close your eyes and pick a place in India, you can find two castes. One is the historically upper caste, the Brahmins. The other is the most powerful caste in that region. How they became powerful is because of the history. Usually, the dominant caste, if you notice, they are the ones who have large population. They are wealthy. They have access to education. And they participate in politics. These are some of the characters of a dominant caste. And then caste identity is an ascribed one. So if you saw here, it was possible for you to change your caste identity historically. Today, caste identity is something you're born with and you cannot change. And finally, regional identity is more important for caste more than pan-India identity. Meaning, a Shudra from Tamil Nadu is a Shudra from Tamil Nadu. And your identity depends upon your region, which state you come from, what language you speak. Manual scavenging. It's one of the most demeaning jobs in India, and it is also from the caste-based system, right? So someone who cleans other people's toilets and empty spit latrines and all that, this is one job performed by a community, and this was something that has been historically passed on. If you take even that group, someone from Kerala, the southern state of India, a manual scavenger from Kerala has their own identity, their own community, and they would typically not entertain marriage relations with someone who does the same job but in the eastern part of India. But if you are looking at it from the historical point of view, from the way the British understood India or the Portuguese understood India, or how the Vedic time period categorized the population, the idea was that if everybody were Shudras, if everybody performed laborer type of jobs, they all belonged to one category and that they were one group. But the reality is that they are not. And these individual groups, generally, throughout different languages in India, we call them as Jati. J-A-T-I. This model is called as Varna model, or the Varna system of understanding Indian society. This way of looking at Indian society is called as Jati model. Jati model is considered to be the reality of India, and Varna model is considered to be a theoretical understanding of the Indian society. Okay. So now that we've established that there are more than four caste groups in India, the next question to ask is, how many castes are there totally? How do we know the history of each one of them? And is caste system present only in India? Three questions to address. So how many castes are there really today? We don't know. We can possibly try to find them through different census data. And up to the census, first census data around the early 1900s, census is where you go and collect demographic details from each family, each household in the country. You get to know about the number of people in the family, what kind of jobs they do, what kind of caste they belong to. And this is stored in a national database. And this census is taken once every 10 years to know the change in the population demographics in India. So this started somewhere around the early 1900s, and the first census data was used to, it kind of acted as a watershed under which all the different categories became more stronger or more rigid in India. It was possible until something is written down that you had the chance to change your caste identity. Maybe you moved from one state, you traveled 1,000 kilometers and went to a completely new linguistic area, and you said that you belong to a different caste and people would have believed you. It is possible maybe you changed your occupation, or you changed the way you behaved, the type of meat you ate, what kind of gods you prayed to. You could possibly change your identity and change your caste. But when it is written down, a person named A living in this city, living in this street, belongs to this caste, there is no possibility of changing it. So the census data, the census data collection, which started with the British governance in India, typically solidified or made the caste system become more stronger and rigid in India. There was no possibilities for mobility within the caste system. You couldn't move or you couldn't change your caste status. But anyway, through the census data, we know there are more than 1,000 castes groups or caste groups in India. How do you know the history of each one of them? If you notice, every caste, randomly again, you just pick some group in India and you ask them, what is your caste? They would tell you a story. Assuming that they are a little bit aware of that, they will have a caste name, they will have a family god, they will have a clan name, and there might be a small history regarding what occupation they historically did, which village did they originate from, depending on each caste. But these are basic parameters through which you can understand the history of a caste. But oral traditions can change. A story that was told yesterday can change today, and it can change tomorrow. But what happened was, in 1900s, there was this project taken up by Edgar Thurston and K. Rangachari, a British anthropologist and an Indian. Together, they wrote 7 volumes of books called Castes and Tribes of Southern India. And in that, starting from A, all the way up to Z, they listed out every small caste name, subcaste name, any identity that people had. And they wrote 1 or 2 lines of description about them. Some castes which were quite dominant in a region or who had a large amount of population, about them they dedicated about 2 or 3 pages. Some castes which were a smaller sub group of a bigger caste in 2 or 3 lines. Are you able to read this? Okay, I'm just going to read the name just so you understand how many different castes were there, are there, and how they characterized or how they were defined. So you see, the first one is Abhisheka. Abhisheka Pandarams is a type of a priestly class, priestly caste. Then Achutali, it is a subdivision of a caste called Vaniyan. The A with the mark on top. A subdivision of a Vaniyan group. Then you have Achuvaru. See, it's in the 901 Madras Census report. Can you see? Madras Census report of 1901. They are Oriya speaking carriers of grain and they went on pack bullocks. This is a description of a caste. They spoke the Oriya language and they were carriers of grain, meaning that they used to collect the grain from an agricultural community and they used to carry it on bullocks. Then Achuvellala, a name used by some of the Pattanavans. Pattanavan is a community or a caste under which they are actually mentioning that there was a smaller group who identified themselves by a different name. And then you have, let's say, all these are just smaller names. Okay. Acharapakam Chetti. Chetti is a very large community in south of India. Chetti or the Chettiars. Under Chettiars, you have many different subcastes. If you are looking at this from the Varna model, Chettiars will just be traders. So, Chettiars should be Vaishyas. But the social reality is that Chettiars are Chettiars. They are neither Brahmins, Kshatriyas, Vaishyas or Shudras. Chettiars are Chettiars. And under them, you have so many subgroups. One of them is Acharapakam Chetti, meaning Acharapakam is a area in which they had settled down. So you have Sene Thalaivar Chettiar, and then you have Karnadukathan Chettiar. So you have different types of Chettiars. Depending on what history they subscribe to or what area they come from. Okay. And if you see, Adapadava, meaning a name that refers to the dressing bag which the barbers carry. A bag which the barbers carry came to identify that entire caste itself. And then you have Adavi, meaning a subdivision of the Yanadi caste. So like this, if you just imagine, just by this half a page screenshot that I show you, you can see so many different subcastes and caste groups. 7 volumes of this describing all the caste groups only in southern India, not in entire India, just the southern part of India. So you see, there are so many different castes and they do not go by the traditional identity which people think is the caste system of India. So the 4 caste categories, it's a theoretical viewpoint, but everybody has their own identity and it is region specific. So presence of caste system in other countries. Typically, when you go outside of India, the easiest thing that one can identify you is, oh, Indians means they have caste system. Yes. But there are other countries that also practice caste system in slightly different versions. That's all. You notice India, Nepal, Sri Lanka, and this Southeast Asian region here, they had a type of caste system, but it's not as prevalent as it is in the other countries. And then you have the caste system in Denpasar of Indonesia, the Bali Island. And it varies in slightly different ways. I'm just going to briefly tell you how it is different. So you know now about the caste system of India. Sri Lanka has historically been part of India and has been annexed by different kings from the southern part of the Indian continent, Indian subcontinent. And you will see that they also have caste system. But what happened was Buddhism took over. And Buddhism's one of the main tenets was that you do not differentiate someone based on their identity. Untouchability is a sin. You shouldn't practice untouchability, and everybody was equal. So more or less, Buddhism's philosophy had seeped into the caste system that existed in Sri Lanka. So today, people identify themselves as Buddhists, but they do have their own regional identity. Marriages have a preferential endogamy, preferential only. Nobody is going to fight with you if you marry someone from another caste identity. But the first person that is preferred is from your own caste identity. But ultimately, all are Buddhists. And in Sri Lanka also, if you notice, castes came from different occupations. You have the Karavas, who are the fishermen. You have the Salagamas, who are the weavers. You have the Vellalas, who are the farmers. Similar to the Indian society. If you notice, the Vellalas in south of India, they were also farmers. So, similar identity, but they've changed a lot because of Buddhism. And if you see in Bali or in Denpasar, you have the caste system. But it's a bit different because if you notice, Sri Lanka is so close to India. So, they were influenced by all the changes that India was subjected to. But in Denpasar, they have different histories and they believe they have a supreme almighty called Sunyan Vidivasa, the God. He is the supreme creator, okay, the almighty. And there are three major gods, the Trinity, Lord Brahma, who is the creator, Lord Shiva, who is the destroyer, and Lord Vishnu, who is the protector. So, in that island, they have these three gods. These three gods we know are Vedic gods or gods who came from the Vedic time period, because that is where they talk about Lord Brahma creating the Indian population. So, this part of the Vedic society has traveled all the way to Denpasar, but then after which it's an island. They didn't go through a lot of changes. So, the Vedic system of caste still remains. So, people identify themselves not by regional identity but by four terms. They are either a Brahmin or a Kshatriya or a Vaishya or a Shudra. But they do not have any marriage restrictions, just a caste identity. A Shudra marries a Brahmin, no issues. It's just my identity. It's like I'm an English woman marrying a German man. That's it. No other social stigma that usually comes with intercaste marriages that you find in India. That is not seen typically in Bali. But everybody has their own gods, and despite the religions, actually if you notice, Brahmins in the Indian Varna model were the ones who usually prayed to Lord Vishnu and Lord Shiva or Brahma. And all those in the other categories had their own regional family gods. Their main god was not the three major gods in the Hinduism, but in Denpasar, those are the three most important gods. So you see how, because of history, the caste system had spread and it has gone through its own share of changes. So in Sri Lanka, it changed because of Buddhism. In Denpasar, it didn't change, and the Vedic caste system still continues to remain. And in India, it has gone through multitude of changes with the different colonial era that has been there and different laws that the Indian government brought to the people after independence, from gaining independence from the British. And in Nepal, you have, they're all Hindus, but they still have the Brahmin, Vaishya, Kshatriya and the Shudra categories. So the next thing is to understand what did the British government do with this idea of caste in India? They had the divide and rule policy. So they used the caste identity of Indians to come up with different policies and different governance models. It was easier to keep the group separated. It was easier to come up with schemes or jobs for the Brahmins and for the Shudras, and they made use of the idea of differences in traditional occupation for their own governance model. And what they did is, in early 1900s, in the late 1800s, the last late decade, they came up with a positive affirmative action or a positive discrimination or an affirmative action program. In India, we call that as reservation system. It is a policy through which historically oppressed parts of the society are given advantages in the fields of education and government jobs. In India, we call that reservation system. In other countries, you either call it affirmative action. In US, they call it affirmative action. In some parts of Europe, they call it positive discrimination. But ultimately, they're all the same type of scheme. So what the British did was, they categorized. See, they're still looking at the Indian society from the Varna model, which we've established is not the social reality. So when they're looking at it from the Varna model, they thought it'd be easier to govern the people through this model. And they decided to give the Shudras, the ones who have been always oppressed, and the Dalits. Right, the Dalits who have faced oppression in terms of untouchability, they wanted to give them slightly better advantage in terms of schooling or education. So, in jobs, if you belong to a particular caste, especially today as part of the reservation system, so let's assume you have four students competing for the same job or for the same spot of admission in a university. So you have four students. One is from the Brahmin community, the other is from, let's just go with the Varna model, Kshatriya group, the other from the Vaishya, and one from the Shudra or the Dalit community. You need to fill that seat through merit. Usually, let's assume the Vaishya student got 100 marks and the others got varying other marks. So, the spot should go to the Vaishya student who got the 100 marks. But how the reservation system works is that, for the same spot, hypothetically speaking, not giving you the exact percentages, for the same admission spot, the Brahmin student has to score 100 marks, whereas the Kshatriya student will have to score 90, Vaishya student 80, and the Shudra and the Dalit student maybe 70 and 60. Got it? If they've all scored these different marks, the spot or the first preference would be given to a Dalit student, and then followed by the other categories. So even if a Brahmin student got 100 marks, the seat allocation would be, that person would be preferred only after admission is given for all those who come from the other communities, even if they did not go through with merit, even if they had gotten a lesser score. So the idea behind this, although this looks like it's called positive discrimination, the government is discriminating the people, but it is positive in the sense, historically speaking, the ones from the Brahmin group, they were able to access education much better than the other groups. Even if they were just educated in Sanskrit, they were still educated. They had the provisions for learning. They had the access to traditional schools of Gurukulam. But the others were not even allowed to go to school. So to help with the historical injustice that was done to the other groups, the government offers a middle ground today. See, if you really look at it, there are two perspectives. Is it okay to give someone a seat just because they belong to a community which was historically oppressed? Two perspectives. Some sections of the Indian population think it is wrong, while some think it is right. We'll look at the right perspective of it. Imagine there is a student from the upper class or upper section of the society who lived in a city in 2019, who lives in a city, was raised in the city, and the reason that person lives in the society, he lives in that particular modern city, is because his ancestors had better social positions that allowed them to live in the city in 2019, while at the same time, a student lives in a remote village with no access to electricity or water, very less amount of food, in dire poverty. The reason that this person was able to live in the city and this person is still continuing to live in such bad conditions is because of the ancestors and what type of lifestyle they had. You are where you are because of where your parents were. At least in the Indian society, this is how it works. And both of them apply to the same university. Of course, the student in the city would have had better schooling. They would have had better access to English medium schools. Maybe they were even able to study without poverty, reducing their quality of life. The other person would have struggled to study throughout their lifetime, throughout the schooling. It wouldn't have been as easy as it was for the other person. So it only seems fair that you give that person the extra push to come to the university. And in the university, the marks are not based on the caste, only the admission. After that, how you study, what kind of merit you gain in the university is up to you and your capabilities. So this was the idea behind the reservation system in India. So for every 100 seats, and in two sectors you see it, in school, college admissions and in government jobs. For every 100% of a particular job, 50% of the quota is reserved for different sections of the population. And according to the reservation system, they have categorized the Indian population into four groups. We are not talking about the Varna model, we are not talking about the Jati system, just the reservation system, which has categorized India into four groups. So you have the general category, you have the backward category. So that those are the names used by the reservation system. So you have the general castes, backward castes, scheduled castes and scheduled tribes. Four categories. This has nothing to do with the Varna model or the Jati model. This is a different interpretation of the Indian society. So all those, if you look at it in the Indian constitution, they do not define any of these categories. We don't know who should be put in what category. How do you know someone belongs to a backward caste? How do you know someone belongs to a general caste? There is no definition as such, but the idea is that all those who enjoyed a historically superior position in the Indian society, they will be categorized in the general caste group. All those who were treated as untouchables, all those who were historically oppressed, they are all put under the scheduled caste category. All those who come in between the untouchables and the high status castes, they are put in the backward caste category. And then, independent from this system, there exists a group in India called the tribes, or the outside of India it is referred to as indigenous population, but in India we will not call it as indigenous population. They are just a group of people who we refer to as tribes. Later I will explain again what is tribes. So just these four sections. I'll repeat again. General category is for all those who enjoyed a high status historically. Scheduled caste consists of the untouchables, and all the in-between castes are categorized as backward castes. So you have different commissions in India which recognizes what caste belongs to what category. For the backward castes, you have a committee called Mandal Committee or Mandal Commission. And it's just a group of people who decide, who get together and decide what is right, what is wrong, who you can put under this group or who you can exclude. So for the backward castes, they actually list out a certain set of points. They look at the census data and collectively examine educational backwardness, economic backwardness and social backwardness. three types of backwardness is what they look for in a particular caste. And for this, census data is used. For scheduled caste, one very important rule. Are you treated as an untouchable? Is that caste treated as an untouchable by the other castes around them? Then you belong to the scheduled caste. And for this, you have a commission called the Simon Commission. And for the backward caste, it's a Mandal Commission. So, just a group of people who have decided on how to categorize the different castes. And all those who do not fall under backward castes or scheduled castes naturally go into the general category. So, 49%, 49.5% of all seats are reserved through these different quotas. So, the idea of the this type of reservation system originated with the British, and the Indian government adopted that system and sort of employed it on a large scale for the Indian population after gaining independence from the British. But what happened was, reservation was supposed to be given for a period of 10 years. When India gained independence in the 50s, 40s, the thing was supposed to be given only for 10 years, and after that, the census data should be collected, and if the social status of a particular caste group has improved, they were supposed to be removed from the reservation system. But until today, it has not happened, because every time they went to do the process of descheduling or removing a group from the reservation system, people started to protest. See, once they enjoy a sort of a free position, it's very difficult for them to say, no, it's okay, we'll go back to having a fair society. But the system was supposed to be a fair system. But what people really look at it as an advantage when you're going to get an admission or a job. So, a lot of people protested, agitated against being removed from the reservation system. Another consequence of the reservation system is that groups from general category often want to go to the backward category, want to be considered as a backward caste by the government. So, they stage a lot of protests in different parts of India saying, no, we were wrongly classified as general category. You have to look at our history. Come and study us and put us in the backward caste category. But you will never notice an Indian caste fighting to go or be scheduled as a scheduled caste, although the percentages are correlated with the amount of population in each category. If you belong to the scheduled caste or a scheduled tribe, it's actually easier to get the job than if you belong to the backward caste. But you will not see a backward caste or a general caste category asking to be put in the scheduled caste. It is because the social stigma of untouchability still continues to exist. But you will see a lot of people from general asking to go to backward castes. But there is another very interesting phenomena. People from other backward, this backward caste group or general category in different parts of India have asked to be put under the scheduled tribe category. Because this scheduled tribe category, the tribal groups, they do not fall under the caste system. So, the stigma is not attached to the tribal category. So, it is okay for someone from this community to ask to be scheduled as a tribe or to be put into the tribal category. So, this is the just an overview of different types of affirmative action programs around the world. In India, it's based on your caste identity. Just a quick overview. In Canada, it's called as Employment Equity Program, and it is given to the First Nation community, meaning the indigenous population of Canada. In US, again, it's called as Affirmative Action Program, and it is given to the indigenous population of United States. Affirmative Action in Brazil is given on the vestibular exams, on the university exams, and this is given, interestingly, just like India, this system is a little bit unfair because it is given to people who are of black origin, but this blackness is decided by their skin tone. So, in the universities, you're supposed to, when you're sending an application, you're supposed to send a A4 size photograph, close-up photograph of your face, and the university decides if you are black or not simply by how you look, how you morphologically look, not by your history or your genetics or who your ancestors are. So this is one type of, because blackness there is considered to be socially disadvantaged and they are trying to give some sort of positive discrimination program. And then you have the black economic empowerment in South Africa, where these people are the indigenous people or those who are the non-white population of South Africa. South Africa is a country where you have both white and non-white populations. These terms are just for identification, not from a racist point of view. Then you have the Romanian people in Romania. They give the affirmative action for Roma people. See, in Romania, you have the Roma people and the Romanians. The Romas are the indigenous people. They are the, they were addressed as the gypsies. And then you have the Shaoxu Minzu in China. It is given for the non-Han Chinese, for the minority groups in China. So you have two groups. One is the Han Chinese, which is the majority of the Chinese population, and the rest are the minorities. And if you notice, the one child policy was also only for the Han Chinese and not for the minorities. Then you have the new economic policy of Malaysia, the NEP, National Economic or New Economic Policy. And this is given to the indigenous Malaysian population. They call themselves as the Bumi Putra people. And for them, same type of quota that you find in India is given. And you have similar positive discrimination policy for the indigenous Fijians. And in New Zealand, you have it for the indigenous people, like the Maori tribe. Affirmative action is given for them. So, affirmative action doesn't exist only in India. It exists around the world. But around the world, who is considered as deserving for this affirmative action, that is different. In India, we use the caste system. And you have standardization in Sri Lanka. There also, you have a type of caste-based reservation system, where the reservation is given for the Sinhalese when they are compared with the Tamils, the two different sections of the population. Not for specific castes as such, but more of a linguistic group. So, the section of the population that is not coming under the part of the caste system are called as the tribes. Historically, imagine, go back to the India map I showed you with all these colorful circles. Imagine there was under all those circles another group of people who were living, who did not participate in this caste system, who did not pray to the Vedic gods, who did not speak any of those languages, any of the mainstream languages, who didn't participate in this type of relationship. As in, see, for a Kshatriya or a Vaishya to get married, they definitely need a Brahmin priest. For a Brahmin to get his shoes or slippers stitched, he definitely needs someone from the Dalit group who specializes in that job. So there was this heavy interdependency between the castes, which you will notice doesn't exist among the tribes. The tribes were relatively isolated when you compare them with the mainstream Indian caste groups. They usually lived in the forest pockets or a bit away from the villages, first thing. Second thing is, they did not participate in the caste system. They did not treat anyone as untouchables. Neither were they treated as untouchables by the caste groups. They had their own gods. Usually their gods, the names of the gods are like forest gods, forest goddess, Kat Devadai. These are kind of the names they give for their gods. These gods do not come from the larger Hindu pantheon. They are not praying to Brahma, Shiva or Vishnu. So they have their own gods. They have their own type of kinship system. They have their own type of political system. And their kinship system, more or less, in many parts of India, if you notice, tribes have a totemistic clan. They trace their ancestry from different natural objects, and also they have moieties. Totemistic clan, one example could be the Santal tribe, and for the moiety type of clan, the Narikuravars of Tamil Nadu. So different tribes in India, and they had their own kinship system. And the types of marriages they did, it didn't follow this caste endogamy, clan exogamy type of system. They simply married within their tribe. and most of the time they were allowed to choose who they wanted to marry. There was no restrictions on intermarriages. But the interesting thing is, each tribe was relatively isolated from the other tribe. So you don't see a lot of intermarriages between the tribal groups. So this is the other group. And for someone to be scheduled as a tribe in India, or to be put under the scheduled tribe category, it has its own history on how the tribes were put into that category. While the British was doing the census data, they also took census for the tribal community. And tribes were first initially called as backward primitive tribes, and then later they were called as backward tribes, because both the terms are offensive. It was later changed to scheduled tribes, which is considered to be a neutral name. But then the idea of primitiveness came along with the term scheduled tribes. But today, the tribes are identified by five parameters. The five parameters have been heavily criticized by both the Indian scholars and the foreign scholars. But then the government continues to use it because of the lack of resources to properly understand how to categorize the tribes. The 5 points were put forward by the Lokur committee. Like I said, for the backward castes, you had a commission called the Mandal Commission. For the scheduled caste, the Simon Commission. For the tribes, you have the Lokur Commission. And the Lokur Commission said that for a group to be recognized as a tribe, you look for 5 things. Are they shy in contacting the outsiders? Do they have primitive culture? Are they backward in nature? Do they have a unique language? And are they geographically isolated? All 5 points, which are offensive and are not politically correct. You cannot call a group as primitive. You cannot call a group as backward. So that is more of an ethnocentric point of view, but still it is understandable that it came from the British government and it is being used today. Okay, so finally, the scientific understanding of the caste system. How can you understand Indian population? So we are going to look at a slightly different angle from which you can understand the caste groups in India. We are going to look at the genetic admixtures of Indian population. There was a study conducted by the CCMB, Center for Cellular and Molecular Biology in India, and they identified 4 groups: ancestral North Indian, ancestral South Indian, ancestral Austroasiatic, ancestral Tibeto-Burman. 4 groups or 4 distinct genetic markers in India, and they believe that the large part of Indian population have varying percentages of each of these genetic markers. It's a very interesting study. I'm just going to quickly go over it. You can read more about it online. What they have done is, see, these are names of different castes. In this, Gond, Ho and Pania, 3 of them, tribes, 3 castes. Okay? And if you notice, we believe that the castes never married they were strictly following endogamy. But if you look at the genetic admixture, you see every caste has the genes from different gene pools. So you have only 4 major ancestral populations. So imagine India being a land with just 4 groups of people, 4 large genetically distinct groups of people who intermixed, and over the span of 2600 or 2700 years, you ended up with such a diverse looking population and so many different cultures. So if you notice that the castes usually have majority of ANI or ASI genes in them. Ancestral North Indian, the people who migrated from the central part of Asia during the Aryan migration time period, during the Vedic time period. ASI, the ones who were already living in India, who could have been the Dasa people that the Vedic people talked about. The AAA is scientifically considered to be the direct descendants of the first settlers who came from the out of Africa migration. And then ATB is a group of population that came from the Mongolian region and settled in the northeastern part of India. Most of the tribes either have AAA gene or ATB gene, which are much older than the ANI or the ASI genes. So this is just an idea about it. If you see the gonads, they have more of the A and I gene with a mix of different ASI, AAA or ATB genes. So what this essentially proves is that in India, no population was isolated as we understand it today. There has been heavy mixing, and also a result of this study claims that the mixing seems to have stopped or slowed down around 2000 years or 70 generation ago. And the study also correlated with the written text of Manusmriti. So they believe until the laws were codified, heavy intermixing was observed. Once the laws became more strict on who you can marry and who you cannot marry, it has become more and more rigid today. To conclude, so how do you look at the caste system today? There are different aspects of how it is being used. One, in politics, where you have different caste groups, they start their own political parties, or they mobilize their caste group, they have their caste organization or a caste association, some sort of institution they start. They look at the welfare of their own caste people. It's sort of an ethnic identity based institution, and they associate themselves with particular political parties and they act as vote banks. And in governance, as we already talked about it, the reservation system. And culturally, this caste system still continues to give one their identity, their own, it decides what is your family god, what is your second name, you know, all these in parameters of an identity is decided by what caste you belong to. And other aspects, there are both good and bad aspects of belonging to a caste system. If you look at the good aspects, few of them is that they give you an identity, some history, some way through which you can relate to the complexity of the Indian reality. And sometimes it's also possible that depending on what category you belong to, maybe you have the advantages of belonging to getting some benefits from the reservation system. But the evils of the caste system. Intercaste marriages, like I already mentioned in the beginning, is only 5% in India, and honor killing is rampant. So honor killing is where when someone marries another person from another caste, especially if it's a marriage between a lower caste and an upper caste, usually it's the upper caste family members who kill the lower caste boy or girl who the person got married to. This is called as honor killing. And then you have Kaap Panchayat system, which is found in the northern part of India. In Kaap Panchayats, it's a local panchayat that is independent of the Indian government. And in this, if you see, the dominant castes, not the Brahmins, but the dominant caste, the powerful castes usually solve problems between different castes, and usually the punishments are oppressive in nature, and they're always targeted towards the untouchables. And untouchability, although it has been claimed to have been abolished, but it still continues to exist. If you go to remote parts of India or even rural parts of India, you can see untouchability still being practiced. So there is two ways in which caste system can evolve in the future. If the reservation system and education and awareness programs, if they continue to have a significant impact as they have done, as in untouchability was practiced everywhere, but it's still practiced only in a small amount. So that change also has to be accounted for. So it is possible that through education awareness programs and the reservation system, that caste system can be abolished or it might change in the future. But if Kaap Panchayat system, honor killing, vote banks and political parties being started out of caste system, if they continue, caste system might only get more stronger. From the evidences, what we know is that caste system or the rigidity of marrying within your own caste and maintaining your own identity has only become stronger from the last 2000 years. That is evident from the genetic studies. So the trajectory of evolution of caste system in the future is unpredictable, and it really depends on the parameters which have more influence in the Indian society today. That's it about the introduction of the caste system. We'll meet again for class later after an hour. Thank you.